You have to follow as much of that as you can possibly think of, not just the stuff you think you're actually interested in.
All right, well, go for it. You have the logins.
Yeah, no, I've been following the fuck out of people. I'm just saying, you know, I've had the logins for, what, like 2 weeks, and we've gotten six followers, so doing something right.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. You are Keith Foster. You live in San Diego. You are the co-host.
You are Cassidy Robinson. You live in Los Angeles. You are the host.
Yes, and today we're going to be talking about the indie thriller, Thoroughbreds, and...
Uh-huh. We're kicking it old school. We're doing an old-fashioned, honest-to-goodness movie review. It's been a minute, yeah.
We're going to be talking about Thoroughbreds, and at the end of the episode, we are going to do the Netflix homework, which you assigned me a long time ago, the last Pirates of the Caribbean movie... Something, Dead Men Tell No Secrets. Dead Men Shall Never Lie.
You know, you're trying to do a bit.
I'm actually really not.
Really? Have you heard the famous quote, Dead Men Tell No Speaky Talks?
Oh, that you're right, that's it.
Dead Men Tell No Shush Words.
Those are the movies we're going to be talking about. There's a little game going on right now on Twitter that we've been kind of caught up in the last couple of days. One of those kind of tag your friend games about favorite soundtracks.
Uh-huh.
And you posted the Whiplash soundtrack as yours.
Yeah.
And I think you did it to be cool.
Not to be cool, but I did it to be like... Like, I genuinely enjoy that soundtrack and have listened to it on its own. Yeah. I wanted to pick something that's not, like, sort of obvious for me. But sure. it wasn't really to be cool. But it was like, the funny thing was, almost right after that, somebody posted the Crow soundtrack.
Uh-huh.
And somebody posted the soundtrack for the 80s Transformers cartoon, right. Both of which I considered.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, I think, like, the Crow soundtrack is just a very people our age kind of seminal movie soundtrack.
Well, the thing that disqualified that one for me was just that I haven't listened to that or even that type of music in a while. So it was like, mm-hmm. Yeah, in, you know, 10 years ago, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
But now, not so much. Now I listen...
more so instrumental jazz music.
Yeah. No, I really genuinely dig the soundtrack to Whiplash.
Well, I think unfortunately it was before you were tagged in the game, but the, I forgot who it was.
Yeah, now
but...
I'm stuck in that fucking thing, by the way, so thank you for that.
You can always mute the conversation.
I did. Fucking did hard.
Whoever posted the, Judgment Night soundtrack, I think, kind of won right off the bat.
I don't know that soundtrack, so no, they didn't. Fuck you.
Judgment Night, let me make sure I'm even getting that as the right name. This is like a Dead Men Tell No Tales kind of situation again.
Dead Men Tell No Secrets.
it was a, like, kind of whatever thriller from, like, the early 90s or something. Had Emilio Estevez in it, and, I want to say Ice-T, but it was one of those things where the soundtrack was better than the movie.
Okay.
And it was a sort of conceptual soundtrack where they got like these like alternative metal bands to record with hip hop artists.
Oh, all right.
And so you had like Helmet and Biohazard, like, and bands like that, and Rage Against the Machine, like pairing with people like Ice-T and whoever else.
I almost posted the La La Land soundtrack.
Yeah.
Also,
I mean, that I can maybe even more understand, because I think there is, like, I mean, that's, like, kind of, like, there's a lot of jazz in that, too, but it's, that's, like, show tunes-y.
Yeah. It's fucking great. Damage Fell, man.
Yeah, yeah.
If I was trying to be cool, I would have posted Black Panther.
Really? I think that would be if you're trying to be basic.
What?
Basic no, AF.
It's cool. It's a cool soundtrack.
But it's, let's not talk about that. Let's instead get into the movie news.
Movie news. Talk about that movie news.
This just dropped today. Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson to reunite for Men in Black. And it's going to be directed by F. Gary Gray, who most recently did Straight Outta Compton, but of course previously done movies like Friday and The Negotiator and other movies. Yeah, I don't know. Is this supposed to be like a full-on reboot? I suppose so.
I kind of hope so at this point. I mean,
yeah.
The article seems to imply that it's a reboot. I'm not totally against this. I like Chris Hemsworth. I like Tessa Thompson. I think there's room in the Men in Black mythology to have multiple characters because it is, you know, it is like this agency. Mm-hmm. And so I actually think it's a little weakened when it focuses on, like, Agent J for movie after movie after movie, because then it right. becomes sort of the Agent J thing. So right. I think it could be good if it has a good script. And I don't know about the director. That doesn't seem like his normal type of fare. But
I mean, he's pretty diverse. Like, you know, I mean, Friday's a comedy, and he did, like, Be Cool, which wasn't very good, but I mean, I
hate Be Cool, all right.
It's nothing like as good as Get Shorty, but...
Sure.
Which, actually, that's weird. Get Shorty was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who directed the first two Men in Blacks.
Oh.
Or maybe the first three.
Well, maybe there's a connection there, then.
Maybe. Like, F. Gary Gray is just always going to get Barry Sonnenfeld's leftover meals.
Sloppy seconds.
Yeah. So I don't know if that spells danger or what.
I don't know. I think they have the right leads. I think, you know, they had really good chemistry in Thor Ragnarok. Mm-hmm. So I think they could have a lot of fun with it. If they have a good script, I'm down.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to, is just how much do they give a shit in the writing process? How much of it is just callbacks, or just trying to retread, like basically just play fill in the slots?
The biggest danger to me is that it's being produced by Sony, which is like sprawling right now. It is like desperate for a franchise. If you need any evidence of that, just watch the fucking Venom trailer. Jesus Christ. Yeah. That's my biggest, like, red flag, is that Sony's even involved with this bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are just franchise fucking hungry right now. We just found out about this movie, like you said, today. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting in the next 6 months or so to hear, well, we're hoping this reboot will be sort of a spinoff into a bigger Men in Blackiverse, and then I'm going to shit my pants and be like, okay, done.
You're probably not wrong about that at all. And, well, Sony has always owned the Men in Black stuff. Actually, over here in Culver City, which is over by where I live, for a little while, the bank that I went to was inside the Sony building, which is this gigantic, weird-looking ziggurat. And in the inside of it, in the lobby, they have a bunch of props from all the movies that Sony's produced over the years, and they have the little wheel bikey thing from Men in Black 3.
I never saw it, so I don't know what that is.
Oh, that was like their big marketing thing. There's bikes that look like wheels. Weird laser bike things with one wheel that you sit in the middle of.
That's just a fucking unicycle. Are you thinking of Tron?
I mean, they were basically Tron bikes, but, you know, not. Anyway, that's happening.
I'm not sold. You're doing a poor job of marketing Men in Black 3 to me right now.
Well, they did a poor job of marketing itself, which actually, Men in Black 3, not that bad. Not that bad.
All right.
Okay. Explain this one to me, Keith.
Okay. Ava DuVernay is set to direct The New Gods for the DC Cinematic Universe. So, The New Gods, this is pretty fucking crazy right here. The New Gods are, how do I describe this? So, you know how in Marvel there's the Infinity Stones and the Celestials?
Sure.
I've already lost you. Okay.
I mean, yes, you know, so abstractly I understand that.
The New Gods are these cosmic entities that exist on this planet. That's where the character, like, Darkseid comes from. Mm-hmm. Did you ever, you used to watch the old Superman animated cartoon?
Sure, yeah.
You know, like, Orion, and Darkseid. Darkseid is sort of their Thanos parallel.
Right.
All of these characters are part of the New Gods. So, what, Jack Kirby basically created his own mythology on this alien planet, and that's what they're doing. It's super cosmic, super Kirby. Yeah, and Ava DuVernay is hot off of A Wrinkle in Time, which I think it might be underperforming a little bit, but...
I mean, I think it was number 2 in the box office, just right behind Black Panther the last weekend.
Yeah, I don't want to... I
don't know what that means. I mean, it's a weird time of the year also, and it's also like people haven't seen anything new since Black Panther.
Exactly. So, I haven't seen A Wrinkle in Time. I've seen clips, I've seen the trailer.
But A Wrinkle in Time was the first big genre thing that Ava DuVernay's been a part of, because, you know, she had done Selma a few years ago, which, you know, was did pretty well and got some awards attention, and then she did the documentary The 13th on Netflix, which I thought was the best thing I've seen from her so far. But you know, this is really in the other direction as far as that goes.
Yeah. So my theory is that DC Cinematic Universe is betting on this being their Guardians of the Galaxy or their Thor Ragnarok.
Or their Black Panther. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it's just a completely cynical move on their part, but that's pretty much what DC Cinematic Universe is known for right now.
Yeah, but I think...
deeply cynical moves, and I would not be surprised if they don't...
I feel like if they were going to do that, though, they would go with at least a black character, like Jon Stewart's sure. Green Lantern, or even, like, try a Steel reboot or something. So I don't think they're... I mean, I don't think it's any coincidence that it's Ava DuVernay, but right. I think, cool, you know, the women of color should have opportunities to direct these tentpole franchises just as much as men of color, just as much as white guys. To me, it's more the fact that they're doing The New Gods that is the really interesting thing to me. That's such a weird franchise to try to make a movie out of. Again, especially with the DC universe struggling to find its legs, I think it's kind of
the most basic shit. Like, they can't get Superman right.
Yeah.
And now they're gonna try and do this, like, off the wall, totally crazy, like, F-list comic.
Well, careful with that. There's some New Gods purists out there.
I'm not saying it's bad, I'm just saying the majority of the kids who are going into the comic shop are not looking for that.
No, I don't even think they're currently doing New Gods comics. I don't know, though. Yeah. I know the characters pop up every once in a while, but so like the nightmare sequence from Batman v Superman is sort of was sort of Zack Snyder's taste of the New Gods, and I just don't think that approach will work. But I hope Warner Brothers is learning that lesson. I think they're going to swing big for this one. It's characters that are totally unencumbered by the baggage of the DC universe. So I think it's kind of a smart move, and I'm pretty excited for it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I'd have to see more about it before I can really have an opinion either way. I think this is...
It's a bold choice for DC. That's what I'm saying. And this is the kind of shit that put Marvel on the map. This could be their Guardians of the Galaxy if they do it right.
Okay. Last story. We had been talking for a while about the possibility of a James Bond reboot, who was going to do it, who didn't want to do it. Nothing was set in stone, but now it is. And it looks like Danny Boyle is going to direct, and his longtime writer and collaborator, John Hodges, is going to write.
Yes, and this is Daniel Craig's last farewell tour outing, right?
Yeah, he's still attached.
Because I heard the last one was his last one, he didn't want to do the last one, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he's been attached and unattached, and...
But look, I mean, that Spectre was not that long ago, but what has Daniel Craig really done since?
Yeah, I don't think he's done much. But also, you know, the fact that he was kind of shit-talking the franchise that made him famous, I don't blame people for not wanting to cast him and stuff. Like, I think he's sort of... he was in Logan Lucky.
That's true.
He was really good in that.
Mm-hmm. He was good in that. And he actually, that's kind of the funny thing about Daniel Craig is like, he's, if you look at a lot of his other work outside of the Bond movies, he's kind of a character actor. Like, he does a lot of like voices. He does a lot of these kind of wild characters. And then these Bond movies sort of like constrict all that for him to play this one kind of like, you know, stone faced spy character.
Again, when Daniel Craig shows up, he's great. Like, in Casino Royale, you know, that's what revitalizes the franchise. In Skyfall, he's great. But in Spectre, he was phoning it in.
Sure.
So yeah. I think it just kind of depends.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, I think Danny Boyle's an interesting...
Well, I mean, that's the real story here, is...
That's the story, because I think, you know...
Has Danny Boyle ever done, like, a franchise movie like this before?
Not really, no. He's an auteur director. Like, his stuff is very much his stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he has, you know, writing collaborators and stuff, and they'll often, like, work together for more than one movie, but, like in the case of Alex Garland or John Hodges, but I don't...
But he's, you know, British, right?
Yes, he's English.
What British director wouldn't want to take a crack at James Bond?
Yeah, and there was rumors for a while that Christopher Nolan wanted to do it, then he came out and said he was definitely not doing it. But yeah, I think it could be an interesting fit because, you know, Danny Boyle likes to have a lot of fun with his movies, and he makes pulp mysteries and like intrigue sort of thrillers, like movies like, Trance, which was kind of a weird movie, but I mean, well, ultimately I mean, it was a whodunit.
28 Days Later is zombie, but you know, he again revitalized that franchise.
Right, but I mean, even
not
elements
franchise, but genre.
Genre, yeah. Even elements of like Trainspotting or his first film, Shallow Grave. I mean, like all of those movies are definitely within like the crime genre.
Like as a British director, you would think that like of course you would want to do Bond, and I think Danny Boyle is the type of person that could probably get a pretty exciting story, especially if this is actually Daniel Craig's like final hurrah. Mm-hmm. I think, and you know, these Bond movies always kind of do this. Like Casino Royale was really good. Quantum of Solace was a turd. Skyfall was amazing. Spectre was kind of a fart. Like, you know, so we're due for another good Bond movie, and I think bringing in a new director with fresh eyes could make it really exciting and hopefully be a really good high note for Daniel Craig to leave on.
Yeah, that's the best that we could hope for. And I kind of have faith in Boyle and Hodges. I think their work, like, I think they have it in them to do something cool.
Yeah, and again, I think it's going to, again, I don't know Danny Boyle personally, but I would think that it's the kind of project he's probably pretty excited about. He's
never done. I think he's generally always excited about everything. Like, the guy, you know, say whatever about all of his movies, there's always a certain kind of glee to them.
Yeah. I mean, even Sunshine, which doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't stick the landing, mm-hmm. is still...
Well, that is a thing. Danny Boyle has third act problems.
Sure. But that's, you know, that's kind of a thing for James Bond, too, so that might work.
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty excited. I was pretty excited when I heard he was attached, because I think if anybody's going to get one last good hurrah out of Daniel Craig, it'll probably be him.
All right, let's go ahead and get into the movies of the week. We're going to start here with Thoroughbreds. This is a movie I talked about when we did our Oscar episode as a movie I was excited to see this year. Little did I know it was going to open the week later. I thought it was further down the line. And it kind of opened in a secret. I didn't know until I opened my phone and said, what the fuck?
It opened about how I expected a movie like this to open.
Yeah.
It's sort of this year's Colossal. Like the
It's a specialty feature.
Yeah.
It's a kind of boutique movie. But,
yeah, like we'll sort of nestle this movie release out in between giant box office weekends to see how it can do, kind of.
Get that alternative programming in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is written and directed by Corey Finley, who is still in his 20s. I didn't know that until I looked it up later. But he's a very young writer director.
Son of a bitch.
I know. Like, when I see the old interviews of Paul Thomas Anderson when he had directed his first film, Hard Eight, when he was 25. So, Corey Finley, very young, first film. He'd done a couple shorts before this. And this is the story of a couple young women. We'll start with Olivia Cooke. As Amanda, she is a troubled teen, we'll say. Her mother has paid Anya Taylor-Joy's Lily to help her with her homework and hope to inspire some sort of friendship between the two and make Amanda a little bit more social in her older age. She is bluntly honest and has issues with expressing emotions or possibly even being able to access emotion.
Yeah, isn't that a sociopath?
I don't know if there's really a word for that. I don't even know if it's necessarily sociopathy, because that's almost more of a legal term. I think you could maybe say she's somewhere on the spectrum.
Okay.
And the movie is kind of ambiguous about this as well.
Well, so, yeah.
The two of them,
Well, she's had some trouble, too.
You learn things throughout the movie about both of them, but
yeah, this is going to be a hard one to do without spoilers, because
without getting into it,
there's a lot of twists and turns.
There is. So the two kind of do sort of grow close is sort of a strange word to use, because they almost, like, it's through complete and utter honesty that they're able to be more intimate with each other than either of them are able to be with anybody else.
Mm.
They sort of grow this world unto their own.
Yes.
And as they get closer, as they begin to open up more and more to each other, Lily, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, discloses that she very much does not like her stepfather. She thinks her mother is in, like, an emotionally abusive relationship. And, you know, sort of offhand, Amanda says, well, why don't you just off him? Who cares? Because that's a type of blunt honesty that she often sort of spouts out.
Plus, and with her incident,
right.
It's not totally surprising that she would go there.
Right, exactly. With her past, we'll say.
Yeah.
This, you know, sort of flirtation with the ideas becomes closer and closer to a reality, and they loop in Anton Yelchin, who plays a local sort of burnout drug dealer who went to their high school some years back, and things get kind of crazy. So,
yeah,
Thoroughbred.
Again, this is we're going to try to not throw out too many spoilers, because I do think this is the kind of movie that is best to sort of let unfold. Because there's a lot of stuff that unfolds.
I will say off the bat, I think that the movie was not marketed. And this is one of those movies that everyone's, like, the people who do go see it are probably going to come out mad because it wasn't what it was marketed
to them. Yeah, I mean, literally on the poster, it says Heathers meets American Psycho, wickedly funny and superbly unpredictable. It's not really that funny.
It's not really a comedy.
No.
It's not even really trying to be. I mean, there is some kind of, like, quick, witty dialogue that happens between the two. And I would say stylized dialogue.
Yeah, but it's not, like,
not necessarily for comedic.
It's not like Diablo Cody dialogue.
No, it's not like a sort of Jennifer's Body sort of campy, like Mean Girls with an ice pick kind of movie, which is what they're selling it as.
Yeah, and that's sort of what I was expecting. I was expecting sort of Cruel Intentions meets Heathers.
Right, yeah, something in that ballpark. And what you really have here, I would say, is a very, almost kind of European-style art film that, takes place with American actresses. And, of course, I didn't say this up front, and it, I think, has a lot to do with the movie. Both of them are very well-to-do, and this sort of takes place in the upper crust of society.
Oh, complete upper crust. I mean, that is...
Yeah, like 1%.
That is a huge part of it, is... One of Lily's big things is she's super privileged, and, like, how much of her stepdad is him actually being a monster versus her interpreting it as that because she comes from such a place of privilege.
Right, right.
Which, I mean, he's not really a redeemer or a likable character.
No, the one thing that I'll say about that marketing campaign is there is sort of a Bret Easton Ellis-y vibe here, and that nobody's a likable character. This is a movie about bad people.
Yeah, I kind of liked Amanda. I actually think she's the most likable. And
ultimately.
And the movie's at first sort of challenges that. It's like it does make her seem really prickly and cold, but as the movie sort of goes on, I start to think, well, maybe she's just misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of a... And a lot of this movie takes place off screen as well. There's a lot that's that true. You don't see, and a lot of it is them talking about stuff. And there's a lot of, like, implied violence, but I don't think there's actually any violence on screen.
There's a little bit. There's some tussles.
Yeah,
there
okay. There's one
the
scene that's, but it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not like stylized or dramatic. So if you're going for like a slasher black comedy, that's not this movie.
Yeah. If you're looking for some splatter, this is. It's not necessarily the movie to go for that.
No, it's pretty cerebral and there's some stuff I want to get into, but I'm like, I don't know if I should.
Well, is there anything you want to say about the movie generally? And then we can maybe go into a spoiler zone.
we'll need a soundbite for that. Generally, it was a lot slower than I expected. It was a lot more careful of a movie than I was expecting. I was definitely expecting something a lot pulpier and campier. But where the script goes and where the camera goes is very intentional. It actually does surprise me to find out that the director's only 20 because...
Well, not only 20, like in his 20s.
Oh, I thought you said he was only 20.
No. He's like maybe 28, 29 or something.
Oh, fuck him then. I thought he was like 20 years old, and I was like, oh, that is shit.
Yeah, he's the arrogant writers of movies.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he definitely knows the tone he wants out of this. I think all, even though the characters aren't necessarily likable, they're very interesting. And I think even the stepdad, who is a pretty broad portrayal, I think there's more, the actor, Paul Sparks, who's a character actor that's been in a lot of stuff recently, most notably House of Cards, always playing this kind of character, like sort of a
smarmy,
like sort of too smart for his own good, kind of just want to punch him in the face kind of guy. I think he's does that well. Like he's definitely got his little niche going. But I think he adds some pretty good nuance to the role.
Well, even though the movie is very deliberately shot, and it's never really like lifting us out of a grounded reality, but there is something almost sort of hyper-real about the tone that does kind of slip into surreal at moments, and I think
that comes just from that.
The tone.
Well, just from that lifestyle, because it's...
Sure, and it's being presented as sort of cold and alien-like, but I think there's a little bit of that going on, and I think there is a little bit of a perspective thing going on, too, where I think we're seeing him sort of through Lily's eyes.
Oh, for sure.
And we're seeing, like, so he could just be like, hey, turn down the radio, and to her, she sees it as this huge affront to her whole existence.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, yes. For sure. I think that is going on.
Yeah, I agree that I was, again, very surprised by just how well-directed this was and how thoroughly directed it was, you know, sort of directed with a capital D.
Yeah, yeah. He had his vision. I will say, I know Ashley was a little disappointed in it because of the way it was marketed and because we saw the fucking trailer for it, like, 100 times when we were watching something on like a streaming channel and they kept playing the trailer over and over again.
Well, I'll say, you know, when I walked out of the theater, I kind of didn't know what to do with it. I mean, I appreciated it for all of its, you know, craft that goes into it, you know, both on an acting level and on a directing level. I thought that it ended a little abruptly and was expecting more of a third act, but it was one of those things, and I'm kind of glad that it took a while for us to get to it, where the longer I thought about it, the more I thought about it, it kind of stayed in my mind for a long time, and I kind of kept going back into certain scenes and certain, like, motifs, and it was sort of grew on me as I thought about it more and more. And now I've actually come to appreciate it quite a bit.
Oh, I really liked it, like, right out of the gate. Yeah. I know Ashley, she thought it was kind of boring. And it is, I mean, I will say, it is kind of a slow burn. Like, if you're not...
Yeah.
Again, the marketing did not do this movie any favors.
No, I mean, but again, how do you market this movie? Like, you know, outside of the art house crowd. Because I would tell people who within a certain sort of art house crowds, like, if you like Michael Haneke and wondered what it would look like, you know, like if a young American director sort of did that with a teen movie... Then maybe, but like, it's almost so European in its feel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if this movie was in French or Austrian, it would 100% make sense. You'd be like, yes, of course. But like in English, with these kind of actors in it and with that sort of marketing campaign behind it, it is gonna feel very left of center for most people.
Yeah, I
can. Even more so than your quote-unquote indie film.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because I do think there is a difference between art film and indie film. If we're talking about indie as a genre.
I don't want to go there.
I don't want to go there, but, you know, like anybody can like 500 Days of Summer. Like, anybody can like that movie. Anybody can like Juno. This movie is not quite as powerful.
No, it's a little more challenging. Should we get into the spoilers?
Yeah, you know, I'm interested in what you have to say about it. So say spoilers on a dramatic way.
Spoiler alert!
So, what are the spoilers you need to go over? Or do you feel that we need to go over?
So my thing is, I think Lily was using Amanda the whole time. I think Lily was the psychopath all along.
Oh, for sure.
And she was, I think the only reason she even wanted to be friends again with Amanda was to get away with this murder plot. From the first time they meet, she is playing Amanda.
Yeah, I do believe that she is a very manipulative person. And I think, because, you know, when we're first introduced to both characters, Amanda tries to come off as very sweet and very innocent and very polite. And then, you know, she quickly kind of breaks that veneer.
Yeah.
Once the two start to open up to each other.
Well, it's like at the first scene, Amanda, you think Amanda has all the power. Because she's sort of testing Lily's waters. She catches her in some lies.
Reads her like a book.
Yeah. But I think all of that was intentional on Lily's part.
I think maybe not initially. I think when Amanda sort of gives her the idea, then a plot or a scheme sort of maybe comes to mind at that point. Mm-hmm. I do think that there is an intentional switch that happens in the movie.
Yeah,
and I think that the director is cleverly kind of playing the two against each other like a foil, like where one starts to mirror the other. They're even both very similar looking in certain ways.
Yeah.
I do think that there was a very intentional manipulation that happens there. But I also feel like, and this is why I think the movie's more interesting than just like a, because that would be sort of more like a Cruel Intentions-y type of thing. I think it's a little bit more interesting than that because in a way I think Amanda wants to be manipulated. And it's almost, in turn, sort of...
I think she's...
Intentionally being a part of that manipulation because she sort of likes the... I don't want to say attention, but...
I mean, she comes out saying she doesn't have feelings, but I think that...
I think that's a manipulation.
Well, also, I think it's sort of untrue. I think she definitely... Like you said, maybe she's on a spectrum somewhere where she doesn't feel them as intensely. I don't know, you know, I don't know enough to diagnose her behavior or whatever, but part of it, what we see in her behavior is also a little untrue. It seems a little untrue because there's stuff from the movie where she clearly cares about Lily.
Mm-hmm.
And if she cared about Lily, doesn't that mean she feels something for her?
See, now you're getting into other territory that I was interested in. I think there is a very, very subtle queerness going on in the movie in general and in this relationship. I don't think it's ever said.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's ever spoken of. Or maybe even... proto-queer in the sense that neither of them have really even thought about it, but it's just sort of lying underneath the surface of the relationship.
Well,
But you look at, like, how, like, their world is very much their world.
Sure.
Like, yes, they're doing a secret thing so they can't tell everybody, but, like, look at, like, them in opposition to men throughout the movie.
Yes.
And how they use men in the movie, and how neither of them are ever talking about boys or ever, like, you know, expressing any kind of interest in that.
But I think that...
They sort of intensely become each other's world. And in the way that the movie uses foils, sort of almost become each other.
Yeah, but I think also we don't necessarily... I don't know that it necessarily has queer undertones because... Female friendship is very different than male friendship. And I don't think that there was anything... I mean, I can see that. I can see that interpretation of it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think textually there's really much... I don't think there's much to either support or deny that interpretation, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like,
I think it might be one of those things that the filmmaker is not aware of. Is happening in the movie.
But well, I didn't
there
really...
There is a little bit of a cinematic history here of what B. Ruby Rich, a film scholar, once called the lethal lesbian movies.
Movies like, I mean, if you're Peter, talking about
Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures, which this movie reminded me a lot of, the Wachowskis' Bound,
or Wild Things, even.
Mm-hmm. And this movie kind of feels like not as lurid as those movies, but it does kind of share some DNA there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
I'll say this to put a cap on that little theory. Whether or not this movie has a queer subtext, I see it will become a lesbian cult film in the future.
I can see that. I mean, I can see how you get that out of it. If it's there, I think it's pretty subtle. I think it's almost disingenuous to discount female friendship that way.
I'm not trying to say that, like, clearly, obviously, they were sexually into each other, and that's why this whole thing went down the way it did. I just meant that the way that the movie, the way that the two characters...
I here's the thing.
How intimate they become in their plan and in their world comes there.
I think you could for sure write a thesis paper about that, but I don't think it's necessarily there, if you know what I mean. I don't know. Because my point is, I think Lily's main arc is that she is using Amanda from the get-go, from the very beginning. We get evidence of that with, like, the mom paying her, to be friends with her or whatever. Like, that's our first sort of clue. And then as the movie unfolds, it's sort of this realization to me that, oh, she's been doing that on a broader scale from the beginning because of what Amanda did to the horse. Because of that story, that's why Lily reaches out to her, because she sees her as this mechanism to getting what she wants with Mark. And I think she is a total sociopath in that at the beginning, she is completely mimicking human reaction, human emotion, human caring. And then it's not till the very end that maybe she did feel something a little bit after all. I think through her own manipulation, she starts to feel something for Amanda, but it's not enough, if you know what I mean.
Right. But I mean, I think the most interesting thing about that final scene is when she tries to stop the whole thing and Amanda lets it happen. It's almost like her gift.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, 100%. I know you don't actually the courage to do this, so I'm going to sort of push you over the edge.
But
Or call your bluff, one or the other.
But I think I almost wonder if Lily telling her that was another manipulation. She told her that so that she would willingly do it to absolve her, because she knew the type of friend she was.
Uh-huh. And what we're saying, that's the juice of the movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is trying to read these characters who have so many layers of separation and of, you know, trying to distance them from regular society.
They're very complex. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very complicated. And
you're constantly trying to read their minds throughout the whole movie.
The reason I think all of this is because of that last scene. I think that's showing us who Lily really is.
Yeah.
Entire time. And showing us who Amanda is the entire time. So to me, I was kind of wowed by this movie. It was actually a lot better than I was expecting it to be.
Yeah, ultimately me too. Once I realized what the movie actually was, I thought, I was like, oh, okay, this is like a Haneke film, but in English.
The real criticism.
Yeah.
And I think maybe this is entirely due to marketing. I did want it to be a little funnier.
See, I thought it was just enough, because there's some good dialogue, some good line delivery, especially from Olivia Cooke, who I've been a fan of since she had a little weird role in the Bates Motel TV series.
Okay.
Both of these actresses come from this like genre, like horror. Anya Taylor-Joy being in The Witch. And then she was in something else recently, that was kind of in this ballpark as well.
Split.
Yeah, Split. That's right. And
is my mic off again? I said that like five times.
I think you might have just cracked out a little bit. And then Olivia Cooke, she was in Bates Motel, and then she was in the Ouija movie. So both of them kind of come from this horror genre.
This is the first thing I've seen her in. But I really liked her a lot.
Yeah, their line delivery all throughout the movie, it has that dry kind of... I think it is funny, in just enough. And then I think you have Anton Yelchin, who kind of comes in as sort of the voice of the audience, even though he's, like, the most fucked up as far as, like, his life.
Yeah.
But he's the most grounded as far as a human being.
Well, again, I think that's commenting on sort of the lifestyle of this 1%. Yeah,
I think there's also, beyond just the story stuff, the character stuff, I think there's also a little bit of a capitalist critique thing going on here, too. Because all throughout the movie, Olivia Cooke's, like, go-to, like, role model or, like, whatever to look up to. She keeps saying, Steve Jobs, Steve Jobs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and again, look at Tim, who is objectively the most sympathetic and likable character, but he is a drug dealer who wants to be running the drug train up the coast and is a registered sex offender.
Right. Well, he's a would-be drug dealer.
But that's what I mean. His whole story is due to circumstance. His highest aspirations are a drug dealer, where her highest aspirations is Steve Jobs.
Right.
And I think there's definitely something to be said about that. And also, Anton Yelchin. Oh, god damn. It made me so sad. Just the fucking career this guy could have had. I mean, he already turned in some amazing performances.
Yeah, especially lately. His last, like four or so movies were, like, big risks, crazy weird movies like this and Green Room, and, like, even the last Star Trek movie he was great in.
No, it's just such a tragedy. He's so talented.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, he's so, I guess, we weren't as spoilery as I was afraid we would be.
No, I don't think so.
All right, what would you give this?
Oh, it's so difficult. I'm going to give it like an A-. I think it is the movie it wanted to be.
Yeah, no, same. I was going to say an A- as well. I would have liked to see it pop maybe a little more, but that could have easily diluted it. So it's hard.
This is one of those ones I'm probably not going to get a full read of till like a second, third, fourth time watching.
Yeah, it's hard for me to say exactly, but I'm definitely excited to see more from Corey Finley.
Yeah, because holy shit, first time out of the gate. Yeah. This is crazy. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into something completely different. Let's talk about Pirates of the Caribbean. Dead Men Tell No Tales, and I will let you describe this.
Do we have a Netflix homework stinger?
Not yet, no.
All right, so this is the fifth and final Pirates of the Caribbean movie. This movie is, it's going back to sort of wrap up whatever loose threads are from the original trilogy. It kind of ignores that number four ever happened. There's a couple little things there. But so we're catching up with Captain Jack Sparrow, who's now well in his 50s. Who's sort of even more down on his luck than usual. Like, before he was down on his luck in a fun way. Now he's down on his luck in a sad way.
His whole crew abandons him.
Yeah, his whole crew abandons him. His ship is stuck in a bottle because of some nonsense in number four that I don't remember. that's where he's at. And then, the ghosts of this Spanish pirate hunting ship
armada
are lifted from this curse through some ghosty nonsense And now they are on a mission to get revenge on Jack Sparrow, who is starting to feel like the only pirate of the Caribbean. At some point they run across Jeffrey Rush's character, Captain Barbossa. And there's some wheeling and dealing there. There's some alliances formed. But basically we've got more ghost pirates hunting after Captain Jack Sparrow for revenge because of some curse. They're
right. And then we have Brendan Thwaites, who's playing Henry Turner, the son of Will and what's her name?
Elizabeth.
Will and Elizabeth.
Yeah,
from the other
movies. Just call him Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley.
And yeah, and then you have a new Keira Knightley in a young woman who can read the sky, and she's gonna be a cartographer or something, and so that they can find this MacGuffin under the sea that does things with curses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't really know what I was expecting out of this. A lot of stuff I heard said, you know, this one sort of goes back to the roots of the franchise because, like, the last
maybe to its detriment
trilogy, some people felt started to jump the shark, and then the number four was just a turd. That one was pretty bad. The one with the mermaids and man, I don't even remember that one. That one is strange because it doesn't even feel connected to the other movies. Like, at least this one feels like it's in the Pirates of the Caribbean universe.
Sure.
It's number four.
I mean, the last one was based on a book. Was based on a book that didn't have Jack Sparrow in it.
And they like,
and then they just kind of shoehorned him in.
Yeah, and you could feel it. It was like,
sure.
And honestly, it probably would have been better if it didn't have Jack Sparrow. Like, if it was just, again, if we're trying to do cinematic universes, we got to get away from just the one or two main characters. Like, there's no reason that couldn't have had all of the mermaids and Blackbeard and whatever and still been in this universe and just not had to do with Jack Sparrow. But that's number four. This is number five.
Yeah.
So,
did you really think this one was a whole lot better?
No. I mean, here's the thing. At the beginning, I was kind of into it. Like, when we got Will Turner's son, and I was like, okay, that makes sense. Like, he would want to lift this curse. And then it just keeps adding, like, magical crap on top of magical crap. And
right. I'm like, and characters. Like, that's the one thing that this series has always had a problem with. It's this more is more approach to story. They're like, oh, so this person's after this thing, and then this person's after this thing, and then why now all of a sudden we're dovetailing into the Spanish army, and then we're also going to bring in Barbados and his people. And like, why? I don't know. It's just there. Yeah, I actually think the fourth one is probably better than this. This franchise in general, and this movie especially, just feels so tired. And there's so much rehashing that goes on here. I mean, you have basically a new Orlando Bloom, you have basically a new Keira Knightley, you have a new ghost boat, it's the same of the arc of Jack Sparrow is exactly the same. It's this kind of redemption story of him, like, being noticed again, or him, like, you know, living up to his notoriety, which they only care about maybe 25% of the time.
Let's talk about the ghost boat for a hot fucking second and how the rules, at least the rules in the first movie, made sense. It's cursed Aztec treasure. You know, when they're in the moonlight, they become like skeletons and you can't kill them. In this, it makes no fucking sense. Like, they take over these ships because they're ghosts. Mm-hmm. But they can kill other pirates, but other pirates can't touch them. So there's sort of this unstoppable spooky force. I was like, ooh, okay, they're even more dangerous than the other ghost boat. I'll at least give them that. But then, like, later on, they're straight up fighting these other pirates, and I'm like, why? Why are these pirates special just because Jack Sparrow's there? Like, it didn't even make sense on, like, movie levels.
No, the game board rules are all over the place.
Yeah, and that's what frustrated me, is I think the...
At some point, at least, especially towards the last third, the movie really feels like it's making itself up as it goes.
Oh, yeah, when they're, like, trying to get the Trident of Poseidon and shit, I'm like...
millions of dollars of CGI just happening all over the place. It's, like, one of the ugliest, like, incoherent, like, set pieces.
Yeah, it's frustrating because I think I actually think the potential was there. I think the premise of this movie worked. It's just the script and you don't even have like the Jerry Bruckheimer, you know, able to sort of curb the nonsense.
Well, I mean, not for nothing, but, like, the first three were directed by Gore Verbinski and are very much part of his aesthetic.
Yes.
For better or worse. You know, what he likes to do as a filmmaker is all over that. And even the fourth one was not done by Verbinski anymore, but it was done by Rob Marshall, the guy who did Memoirs of a Geisha and Chicago.
I think the first one's solid, right?
Uh-huh.
I think, honestly, the second one's my favorite. The third one is where it starts to go crazy. but it still works enough to sort of fill out the trilogy. The fourth one, I think is really ugly, boring, unfun movie. And then this one is just nonsense. Like, I think it at least gets, I don't know. I think its heart was in the right place. It just, they kept adding shit on top of shit, and I was like, let's just, like, there's enough to deal with just wanting to save Orlando Bloom from this curse. Like, that's enough. Let's just deal with that and have the ghost pirates trying to stop them. You know, like, why can't that just be the thing? Why do we have to add this fucking compass spell and ghost sharks and a trident and the lost...
I just now remembered.
Yeah.
And I just now remembered at some point in this movie, there's like a weird bald witch.
Yeah.
I just now remembered that that's a thing and doesn't, like, nothing...
Has zero payoff. Let's talk about the British fleet that literally disappears.
Mm-hmm. Half this movie disappears, like... I'm telling you, there was a point when, like, I guess, like, the movie was wrapping up, and I was like, wait a minute, why is any of this happening? What's actually going on right now?
Yeah. No,
like, the movie just kind of explodes into CGI nonsense for the last 40 minutes, and whatever story was there, which honestly, to me, it just felt like they just took the Black Pearl screenplay and plugged in different names and slightly different events and worse dialogue.
It was like they took the Black Pearl screenplay and mashed it up with 2 and 3, the worst parts of 2 and 3. Yeah, it's a mess. This movie's a mess.
And kind of like bad looking, like a lot of the times, like, you know, for as expensive as this movie is, like there's a lot of obvious green screen and there was like the whole like effect behind Javier Bardem and his goats. It's like, okay, you figured out how to do something in some program.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought the ghosty effects were fine. Like, I thought they were spooky ghosts. that's all I need. You know what I mean? Like, I thought that was fine.
And how bored does Johnny Depp look throughout all of this?
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, it's like, whatever was there with Jack Sparrow just is not anymore.
No.
I mean, when the first one came out, I got it. He's like a fun, you know, he was sort of the modern Indiana Jones. And
sure, and it was an unexpected turn for him at the time, and it was
it brought life
into what should have been a much worse movie based on a ride at Disneyland.
Yeah, and there hadn't really been any big sort of movies like this
adventure film.
Yeah, and that's what I like about the first three is they feel like they take me back to that sort of Spielbergian era of Indiana Joneses and, you know, George Lucases and things like that. And I appreciate them for that. But much the same way that Indiana Jones should have stopped after the third one, this, I think, has a lot of parallels to the fucking Alien movie.
Crystal Skull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's the lead character is old and tired. There's nonsense going on. There's almost some potential of premise, like, you know, Indiana Jones and the Cold War on paper sounds good, but just it's just too much. There's too many concepts, and the character that we liked from the first movie doesn't come through. The actor doesn't give a shit. The writers don't give a shit.
The writers really don't give a shit. This is the worst dialogue I've heard in a while. Like, and so many attempts at Woody Baker that just fall hard.
Yeah. No, I agree. Like, almost everything the girl says, I think everything the girl says, and it's not her fault. She was fine as an actress, but everything she says is some sort of exposition. And then there's, like, her whole weird plot twist with, I think the only one who was fun in this movie was Jeffrey Rush.
Yeah, he's one of those kind of actors, though. It's kind of...
Yeah, but it shows, like, he was the only character I cared about. He was at least...
And he's the one that has the least to do with the plot. He has no business being in this movie.
Except in the third act, they try to, like, write this whole arc around him, and I'm like, no, just let him be a fucking pirate. Like, you don't need all this stuff with...
So there's all this, like, supposed to be emotional payoff in the last 15 minutes. I didn't care. Like, when Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley run out into the field, and I'm like, I was like, don't give a fuck about any of this.
Yeah.
If there's an opposite to emotional payoff, that's what I was having.
No, I agree. I almost completely agree. I was bummed out because I liked when they introduced Jeffrey Rush. Captain Barbossa's always been one of my more favorite characters because he was always the pirate that Jack Sparrow wasn't. Like, he gave a shit. He was that pirate. And we were introduced to him being this, like, uber pirate. And then he's, like, you know, making a deal with Ghost Boat. And I'm like, oh, okay, so he's kind of flipped again, and I like that dynamic. But then when they start complicating his story, I'm like, what is this? What? Why? What are we doing? What are we doing? Just let him be a cool pirate who's, like, backstabbing people. Like,
there was, like, 20 minutes of the movie when I thought I was, like, gaining some traction. Like, towards the middle, when they're, like, set to sail and they're, like, off to go find a thing. I like those kind of movies.
Yeah.
And I wish that it would just paste itself a little bit and sort of,
that's
like...
That's what I mean, just...
Like, there's this whole thing with this character who, like, reads the stars. She never gets to actually do that in the movie. They could have done something with it.
Also, they're fucking pirates. How... What? They're fucking pirates, and she's the only one that can navigate by the stars? Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, I was willing to overlook that just for the sake of, like,
giving her
something to do in the movie other than just, like,
but even that being doesn't upset make sense and angry. Because she has this map that's given to her by her father, who she doesn't know is Jeffrey Rush, but then it turns out it's Jeffrey Rush, but for some reason they still need her to read the map, even though Jeffrey Rush was the one that made it? Like, there's so many plot holes, because they couldn't just, like, stop and let it be an adventure movie. It's like the writers were afraid that if 2 seconds of this movie went by without some weird pirate myth coming up,
magic
the audience would just be like, what's fucking going... What?
What do you mean they're just in a boat sailing? Where's why haven't they dealt with the Bermuda Triangle yet? Why haven't they dealt with sea monster? What? So it ended up just being a hot mess because the script was no good. And the director, nobody gave a shit except Jeffrey Rush, kind of.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'd give it a D plus.
That feels kind of generous. I mean, it's so cynical. I maybe just a D, just a D.
The plus is hanging on Jeffrey Rush and ghost sharks, I guess.
Yeah, the zombie sharks, that was a thing for a minute. That was like part of that part of the movie I almost cared about. Once they get on that island,
yeah.
It was literally like I must have like fell asleep for 30 minutes and missed something.
No, I don't.
Because I was like, I didn't get what the fuck was going on anymore.
No, but you're right. Like with that island, and there's almost a fun bit with like these cannibal pirates that are going to eat him. And then Barbossa comes and I'm like, oh, cool. We're going to have some actual like pirateness that doesn't involve pulling a building through a fucking town with four horses.
Oh, they just took that right out of Fast Five and replaced cars with horses. They just stole somebody else's set piece.
I didn't know that, but that makes more sense with cars because they're not horses.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, this movie's trying to be spectacle, but none of it's grounded on anything, so there's no reason to give a shit. The only thing that this movie is counting on is the fact that you're attached enough to the franchise to give a fuck about the characters, but I'm not.
Definitely not.
And this movie does not.
Hopefully, this is the last one.
At all. It's supposed to be.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I looked this up. The movie failed in the United States, but it tripled its earnings overseas. So now we have the Ice Age scenario, where these movies are no longer being made for us, they're being made for China. So we might still get them, whether we want them or not, because they do well overseas.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I think I'm pretty much done. I thought, again, from what people had told me, I thought after four was... I think I'm done.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Okay, so that's that. The Netflix homework I have for you next week is we're going to give it to Gosling, Keith. We're giving it to Gosling. We're going to have us review his first big dramatic feature, or one of his first big dramatic features, Half Nelson, which I believe he was nominated for, maybe if not an Academy Award, other stuff.
Is this a wrestling picture?
No, it isn't.
Sounds like a wrestling thing. I mean, Half Nelson.
You would think so, but I've never seen it, but it's been on my list. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. So if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about here, if you're one of the 12 other people who saw Thoroughbreds, or if you have some hot takes on the Pirates of the Caribbean movies or Half Nelson, or whatever it is we end up talking about next week, go ahead and email us. You can send us some audio like Patrick did. We'll play your hot takes right on air before we launch into our reviews. And you can do that at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Instagram, where we're trying to be more active and trying to post some pictures and stuff. I might try and take some, like, I don't know, at the movie selfies or something. I don't know. We'll see what happens on there. I'm new to the whole Instagram game.
That's a cute idea. That's fun.
Maybe some marquees or something like that.
Yeah.
A picture of my Sour Patch Kids. I don't know.
Okay.
Also,
I don't know if we ever mentioned this, but I think we have an iTunes.
We're right? on iTunes. I always say that you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher.
Yeah, but. But we don't often say to rate and review us. Please rate and review us so that maybe some more people who you think might enjoy the show might be able to check it out. 5 stars, please.
Yeah, if you haven't yet, give us a 5-star rating and a 1-sentence review. It pushes us up in the algorithm. That's how we end up like doing better in our like channel or whatever, the the entertainment and movies section of iTunes. It's kind of a mystery how that whole thing works, but apparently that's how it works.
Yeah, rate and reviews always helps.
Yes. So you can find us there. You can find us on Stitcher Radio. You can also find us on Player.fm, Pocket Casts, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. You can read my reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladborkreviews.blogspot.com. I have a review that's going to be going up soon for The MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy for a documentary that premiered at South by Southwest called Alt-Right, The Age of Rage, I think is what it's called. Where do you want people to go, Keith?
Follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid. Follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Well, that's pretty much it right now. Go to my website at www.keithfosterkid.com. Have me on your podcast.
Okay, that's an open invite.
Yeah, I like doing other people's podcasts. It's fun.
Keith is a slutty podcaster.
Yeah. Hey, at least I'm trying to promote the show.
Yeah, hey, whatever helps. And what was I going? Oh, yeah, you can follow us on our Twitter and Instagram is at Jabber Podcast, by the way.
Yes.
I don't think I said that. So we also have friends who do podcasts that you should be listening to that include Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, Denise over at Mascot Diaries. I think she just posted her last episode, but you can go back and listen to the archives. Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, and Mike Fallick at Let's Start a Cult. There's others.
Yeah, also follow the Adamant Podcast with Adam Connie and Campfire Shit Show, but shit is spelled S-H-T. Yeah, it's to avoid, like, censors and stuff, so Campfire S-H-T Show.
Cool.
My friends Bo and Merrill.
All right. Have you been on that yet?
No, but I just talked to Merrill, and I'm gonna be on it soon. I think. I hope that'd be fun.
Okay. That's the episode.
Yeah. The sign out this week is Dead Men Tell No Secrets.
Bye.